Welcome to Power, Strength and Vulnerability, the Mental Health Podcast. It's time to make mental health a normal conversation with your host, Shane Kelton.
All right, welcome to another podcast, Power, Strength and Vulnerability. I'm your host, Shane Kelton, and today I have a very open and honest guy. He's a bit of a legend, sort of to me. Met him a couple of years ago through a footy club. And yeah, just sort of kept in contact ever since. And his name is Pete Cassidy. Welcome, Peter.
Thank you, mate. Thank you.
It's good to have you on. We have missed a couple of times we were meant to chat. In the past couple of probably 6 weeks, so it is good to finally get on the line. Even though it's over the internet, like everything has to be at the moment.
Yeah, you're right, mate. Yeah, it's been a bit of a struggle with all this fire stuff going on. So, let's do it, mate.
So, basically, we're going to talk with you about a lot of things, and it's going to be very interesting for myself, but I think also the listeners as well. First thing I want to know is I kind of want you to – so you're 29 now?
29, mate, yeah.
Yep. Nearly 30, geez. And I want you to paint a picture of what your childhood looked like early on, just how people may have perceived you and the family and the environment you lived in.
Okay. All right, so I suppose we'll just start from the beginning. Growing up as a kid, Dad was a big alcoholic. Used to get pissed all the time and smash things, and probably wasn't the greatest childhood. Mum tried to really look after us and kept us in sport and made sure we had everything that we had to have. I don't know where you really want me to go with this. Yeah, it was sort of, I suppose it was a bit rough. We didn't have all the money in the world. We didn't have the best clothes or the best shoes and all that sort of stuff. We were an average sort of family. We weren't, it wasn't a real loving sort of upbringing.
That's quite different to a lot of the people I've spoken to. I've had, not all of them, but I've spoken to people who have had little issues in the family. But I guess for you, it was quite seeable what was happening around you. Were you recognizing that this wasn't, I guess, a normal environment at a young age?
Well, and I suppose it sort of felt, it was so regular that it sort of felt normal to me. Obviously, it wasn't nice to see, or even hear. I suppose it happened so regularly that, Dad getting pissed and being up dancing in the lounge room by himself till, 3-4 in the morning. It probably at the time, might have scared me, but it didn't seem out of the ordinary because that was the norm.
That was your normal.
Yeah, that's it. That was my normal, mate. So,
I'm guessing, you went to school like everyone else. You played sport. You probably had lots of mates.
Yeah, mate.
All of that kind of stuff.
Yep. So outside of the home life, I suppose I lived a really good life. I grew up with the kids that I went to creche and kinder. I went through, creche, kinder, primary school, high school, all that sort of stuff with the same mates, footy, basketball. So outside of the home life that I sort of knew, it was good. I had good mates, they were always there and supportive and all that sort of stuff. And I probably, which is probably a massive wrong now that I look at it, I probably hid away what was going on at home. I didn't talk about it, or I might have just blew it off. And Outside of the home life, yeah, I had a really good life. I went to a good school, had good teachers, you know. I was always in sport, you know. I had basically everything that mum and dad could afford. But yeah, it was just the home life and things that sort of happened along the way that pushed me off the track.
So you said, you know, you kind of ignored it all and blew it all off, and that. Well, I mean, what would your advice be out there for kids and teenagers today who might have this going on at home? Because, I mean, as we'll probably discuss maybe in the next, I suppose, half an hour, you probably would have, if you could have, probably done something differently. What would that be?
Talk, mate. That's probably the main one. I probably would have spoken about it, whether it had been with my parents, or, you know, if you can't talk to your parents, even just a friend, just anyone, because you don't realise, especially being so young, how much it's going to affect you in the long run. I mean, I'm 29 now, so it's taken me, you know, I've probably had problems since I was 5, 6, when I could actually start remembering and realise what was actually going on. It's taken me, you know, nearly 25 years to actually realise that I have serious problems and I need to talk about them and let it all out rather than bottling it up, because, it certainly doesn't help.
Yeah, you're 100% right there. And it's as kids, and we look back and we think of these things and we're like, oh, it wasn't that bad, but the trauma we feel as a kid is that bad as a kid. It is, you don't know how to make sense of what's going on. And I guess, and you're probably the same, it's when you get older, you start to realise that it wasn't normal and, you know, it did affect you, and that's probably what you're going through a lot now. So we spoke briefly off air about something that sort of happened around 13, and I think it's really pivotal in, you know, I guess, part of the trauma that you've experienced growing up. And I just think it'd really be good if you paint that picture for the listeners now.
Yeah, cool, mate. All right. So basically I grew up with a guy, my dad. His name's Darren. He's actually my stepdad. And then when I was about 12 or 13, I've got photos of Craig. He was my father. So I got photos of him. I always knew about him. Mum always was really open about it and all that sort of stuff. They split up when I was born, when I was really young, and then Dad came in and sort of took the reins and, done the best job he could, I suppose. And then I was at a festival in Croydon on a ride, actually, and I still remember I got off the ride with my brother-in-law, Paul, and my older sister looked really, really concerned. And my brother-in-law was like, what's going on, Nick? And she was like, oh, nothing. And I could tell something was up, something really, you know, disturbed her or worried her or something like that. And then I got home later that night, and then Mum came in and she said to me, oh, look, Nicky saw Craig at the festival today. He asked to see you, and what do you think? And I just remember saying, because I grew up with, you know, Dad and all that sort of stuff, I was sort of like, why now? Why does he want to, you know, see me? Mm-hmm. He hasn't been here for me whole life, you know, why? And I sort of said to Mum, nah, look, I don't want to see him. You know, I've got my dad. You know, I feel bad, blah, blah, blah. Anyway, Mum sort of said, you know, you'll always be your dad, and you know, it's really up to you. So I sort of come around to the idea, and my best mate, Chris Robertson, his dad and Craig played at Belgrave Footy Club. So the first time we went out, Uncle Stu said, look, mate, I'll come with you. We'll go out on the boat, you know, you, me and Chris, and we'll go out with Craig. And we had a great day. And so then we started hanging out. I went to the footy with them and had dinner and went to their house and met his new wife, Nikki, and they got three daughters. So I met them, started hanging out with them a fair bit, and went to that the speedboats down at Caribbean Gardens there. Went there and all that sort of stuff, and we're driving home and he said, you know, is there anything you want to ask me, blah, blah, blah. And I just said, oh, look, like, where have you been and all that sort of stuff. And he said, you know, bloody, you know, look, I'm sorry and all that sort of stuff. And I said, yeah, that's sweet. And, you know, I was sort of happy that I'd, opened up and met him and all that sort of stuff, because he was a good dude and probably just a bit young and immature and didn't really know how to handle the whole situation, I suppose. So, yeah, so we ended up getting a paternity test. First one came back negative. And then mum was like, nah, it's not true, it's not true. So we got another one. And then I came home one day and there was a letter in a letterbox and said my name on it. Opened it up and, yeah, it said, yeah, Craig's 99.9% not the father. So that was probably, yeah, the first big turning point in my life. I didn't really know how much it affected me. Obviously, yeah. But yeah, that's probably, yeah, one of the biggest ones, especially being so young and not dealing with it. And yeah, even to this day, it still cuts real deep. And yeah, it's
I mean, there's one thing I want to point out before we talk more about this, but you said, talking about, so your stepdad, David, your stepdad?
Darren,
and then Craig. So what you're actually pointing out about Darren is that he did the best he could, and I think that's really important to mention that, you know, we probably mentioned a couple of negatives here about him, but he did the best he could in the circumstances around that. I think you said that, and I think it's just, I just want to mention that as well, because that is really important that we say that. You just been introduced to what you thought was your real dad, and you started getting along. So I'm guessing the feelings were of happiness and content that, you know, you think you've got that person back in your life.
Yeah, mate.
You may not have thought you'll ever get them back.
Oh, fuck, what have I done? Hang on, Shane. I don't know what I've done here, mate.
You're all right.
So I suppose mum always was really open about it and, you know, showed me photos of them and all that sort of stuff. She's still got them in her, you know, in her folders and all that sort of stuff. She was always really open, but I never questioned her or never, you know, it was what it was. You know, they never really seemed to be any opening to meet Craig. So I sort of just left it. And then I suppose I always knew about him and there was probably always a void there, regardless of how I felt when I found out I could actually meet him. I probably always felt, you know, like a little bit like, I mean, you know, he was supposed to be, you know, my biological father. So I suppose a part of me wanted to know who he was or, you know where I came from or, you know where, what, how did I get me colored eyes because mum's got brown eyes and why do I have black hair? And I sort of wanted to know all that sort of stuff. Yeah, so when it sort of all happened, it sort of, yeah, sort of completed me. And then to find out that he wasn't, sort of ripped me apart. After I got that letter, I didn't say anything. I went to my room. I remember going to my room and I cried. Left the letter on the table and mum came in and said, oh, you know, I'm sorry. And then, yeah, that was it, mate. I never spoke of it again.
Wow.
Yeah.
Through the next couple of years, do you remember thinking about it or was it you just shut it off that much?
That was it, mate. I was done. Yeah.
Done?
Killed me, mate.
Did you continue contact with Craig after that or was it just shut the whole situation out?
I suppose, I ended up having my best mate's 18th, probably a few years, probably 2 or 3 years later, up at Belgrade Football Club, actually, and he worked in the bar up there for me best mate's 18th. So I sort of saw him, but it was just, I suppose, after it all happened, I spoke to him and saw him, and he said, you know, look, we'll catch up and it's not your fault and all that sort of stuff. But I suppose I knew and he knew that it wasn't going to work. You know, I wasn't his son, and so it's sort of, I spoke to him a little bit after it happened, from what I can remember, but it sort of just fizzled out, and I sort of just let it go. I didn't want to hold on to something that, you know, wasn't going to be, I suppose, mine forever, and I sort of just shut it out. And I saw him a few years later, and, you know, said g'day, and I haven't seen him since. So it's a bit of a bummer, but I suppose it is what it is, and
I mean, what did the next few years for you look like through high school, through those, until you're sort of 18, 19? You know, it's sort of to paint a picture, but also to 18-year-old for males, and so 16, 17, 18 is when we start to drink and find the party scene and girls and the rest of it. So, I mean, what did it look like, this transition period, that, you know, we now look back at 30 years old and go, fucking hell, what did we do? What were we doing? Yeah. Why were we doing it a little bit? But, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I suppose it sort of looked a lot like my younger home life. You know, they say you sort of grow up and become what you've been, I suppose, exposed to. You know, drank till I couldn't drink anymore, or I vomited, and I was at parties every weekend, and, you know, I wasn't, my grades at school weren't doing well. I mean, I left school when I just turned 16, just before I turned 16. So I left school in November when I was 15. And went and started working. You know, I was going to work on Friday straight from like Ringwood on the train into the city, and, you know, turn up to work pissed, and just getting home at 4 o'clock and just doing all sorts of dumb shit. Which wasn't good. But yeah, probably went off the rails after that, I suppose, yeah.
Despite drinking and working, and what did the weekends look like? I mean, there was probably drinking, but you're playing sport, you're socialising and stuff like that. So were people picking up what was happening?
I suppose probably I was, even to this day, I'm very good at hiding either what's going on or how I'm feeling. So I suppose being 15, 16, 17, everyone was sort of doing the same thing, probably not to the extent that I was, you know, drinking and starting to do party drugs when I was getting 17, 18. So I suppose they would have known I was going a little bit harder, but, I never really voiced how I was feeling or anything like that to my mates. I sort of just plodded along and pretended I was fine. You know, but when the weekend came, you know, I'd play rep basketball on the Friday night, normal basketball on the Saturday, and then the Sunday I'd play footy. Most weekends I'd be turning up to under-16s football pissed on the Sunday. Any time I had a chance to drink, being young and dumb, I suppose I took it and wrote myself off. Probably seemed normal to me at the time. I mean, everyone was sort of, you know, drinking a little bit and all that sort of stuff. But, that's probably what my weekends look like, mate. If I could get a drink in, I'd have one. Otherwise I was playing sport and just hanging out with mates.
Looking back now, was it a clear thing to avoid? Was it an avoidance thing? Was it an avoidance of feelings? Was it an avoidance of what might have transpired through those early teenage years?
Yeah, look, I'd probably say so now. At the time, I probably didn't think so. So it hasn't been until really, I mean, I see a psychologist now every week, either once or twice. I'm actually seeing a relationship counsellor for other issues as well. It probably hasn't been until I've actually sat down and done this sort of stuff. I mean, I'd done a men's behaviour change program a couple of years ago, and that really opened up some old wounds and made me talk about things a little bit better and all that sort of stuff, and then sort of went off the rails. Not off the rails, but got back into drinking a little bit and just not doing things I should be doing, going to work and et cetera. I didn't really know back then, but now looking back, yeah, it probably was a bit of a coping mechanism to deal with, you know, obviously what I hadn't dealt with. It was obviously something really big that I sort of just pushed aside and pretend it didn't happen. So, I'd say, definitely, mate. Yep.
I think I'll probably get this as a bit of a statement, but I'll get your say as well because you do have kids. But I think what you basically described in these first 20 minutes is that you were shown a way to adapt to life, and that's the adaption you followed going forward when things got tough for you. Whereas if you were shown a vulnerable person who opened up and spoke in front of you, now that doesn't matter who that is. It could be someone at school, could be a teacher, could be a parent, could be a sibling, could be an auntie, uncle, whatever. If you were shown how to talk, and it's not about going up to a kid and saying you have to talk, it's about showing them that you're vulnerable. That may have made things look different for you going forward. But I guess the question to that is, how important do you believe that statement is now that you have kids? Because it changes everything.
Yeah, it certainly does. So probably in the kids' earlier years, I was probably a lot like my dad, you know, playing footy and then not coming home till Sunday night, which isn't a good look. I definitely agree with the statement. Dad obviously come from an era where, especially being a Kiwi, where I mean, just for instance, we went to his mum's funeral over in New Zealand. They do it a bit different than they do it here. You actually go and dig the grave by hand and sleep with an open coffin the night before and all that sort of stuff. And I remember standing next to Dad when they were lowering her down, and Dad said to me while I was crying, "Don't cry." And you know, that's sort of how he was brought up, and that's what I saw. So, and you know, like, I idolize him still to this day. I've always idolized my dad. So I sort of grew up, you know, thinking that was the way. And yeah, it wasn't until I started actually working on myself and softened myself up a bit that I started passing that on to the kids. So it's taken me a lot to get to where I am. It's definitely hard changing, you know, nearly 30 years of habit.
I talk about this a lot with people because, I mean, our generation grew up with parents who were very, they weren't very emotional to people. Yep. They were holding in, protect the kids. Now we're heading into a generation, which I actually reckon it's going to go completely, it's going to backflip and it's almost going to go too far. But I think somewhere along the way we're going to find the right balances, because you do need to be realistic about this. You need to show vulnerability, but there's also times where you need to be resilient and you do need to show a bit of strength and character. So there's that fine balance, and I think our parents were really good at being strong and resilient but weren't very good at being vulnerable.
Yeah, 100%.
Which has left us in the age of social media and comparisons and the rest of the shit that's going on. We don't know how to talk about the shit we're going through very well, but we're slowly getting better at it. And I guess the point to that is, there's no blame towards our parents at all. Like, I love my parents. As you said, you idolise your dad. They did the best they could with what they knew, and they ingrained in us so many great things. It was just we're missing a couple of things, but no parent's going to get 100% right.
Well, yeah.
I think I just always think that's really important to speak about, especially because I know people listen and they go, oh, they're blaming. We're not doing that. We're not sitting here blaming them at all. We're just saying these are the adaptions that can come from what you see growing up, and maybe this will help change something in someone else's life.
Yep.
You spoke about your drinking and your drugs, and there was a time which we briefly spoke about off air where I'm going to say this, and I'm not trying to sound rude, but drinking took priority over a family event, which you sit back and you probably wish that your values and beliefs were a little bit different. What was that?
Yeah, you're certainly right, mate. I actually, my ex-partner, who is my youngest boy, River's mum, I actually lost a family because of drinking and drugs and partying and, you know, putting myself first rather than my two boys. So that hit home pretty hard. That was a big wake up call. I mean, that was probably the lowest I've been, mate.
How long ago was that?
About 3 years ago now. After that happened, I sort of got pushed into to doing pushed myself into doing a men's baby change program that I spoke about, and started making some changes. I mean, I'm not there yet, and I don't think I ever will be. I think that's the problem where I've sort of gone off the rail every now and then. I've got a bit complacent and thought, yeah, you know, I'm okay now, and sort of I suppose it's really helped me realize the effects that all those things that I went through as a child and even as I got a bit older, it's made me realize the effect that it actually had on me, and that it's probably going to be lifelong. So there's been lots of times, you know, that I've sort of seeked help and then sort of, you know, come good and I'll be good for a few months or even a year and then you know, sort of go back off the rails. So I think it's taken me 29 years to realize that this is probably going to be lifelong. You know, obviously not blaming anyone, but I suppose I've just got to keep on top of it and, you know, keep seeing my psychologist and all that sort of stuff and keep putting in the work to get where I want to be.
Yeah, you've also, I guess, realised something. Now, this is something we just talked about as well. You also realise that you probably didn't go things the right way with your nana as well. That was when you were 18. So there's probably... I mean, there's years of you going to alcohol rather than other things, I guess. Yeah. So I guess I want you to talk about here is what that impact has had on you now and on reflection, because at the time, yeah, probably pretty cut up, which people will understand when you explain it, but it sort of was a bit of a pattern for you.
Yeah, it certainly was, mate. I sort of seeked an escape every time things got bad, you know, or didn't go my way, or, you know, I couldn't control a situation. I probably turned to drugs and alcohol and looked for that escape. It certainly has been a pattern, probably a learnt behaviour throughout my childhood and all that sort of stuff. Again, not blaming anyone, but sort of what I, you know, was exposed to and sort of the path that I chose to take rather than talking about it. I mean, there's lots of things out there now, you know, that say talk and all this sort of stuff. We obviously didn't have that when we were younger. It's only come through the last few years. So I suppose I sort of I always wanted to talk about it. It just didn't seem like a sort of a viable option, I suppose. It's certainly taken a massive toll. I mean, I've probably messed up two opportunities at having a family with Bowden's mum and then Rivers. not to mention all the stress that I put on my parents and my family and all the worry that, you know, even Nan had up into her last sort of days. She was sort of asking where I was and what I was doing, and I was probably too busy out partying and getting on the piss, so I didn't have to deal with it.
And what happened with that situation with your Nana? So this was when you were 18.
Nan, we found out Nan had cancer, which was, she was a big smoker and she got cancer and got told that she wasn't going to be fixed, and she had about 6 months to live. So she ended up living about 12 months, which I suppose was really good. And, the drinking, the last 2 weeks in Nan's life, I probably drank every single day, I reckon. I remember just seeing her go to the toilet, you know, crying because she was in so much pain. And, sorry, mate. Give me a sec. Now I've forgotten what we're talking about, mate.
Toilet. Your mum was going to the toilet.
She went to the toilet and just saying that sort of stuff and, escaping and getting on the piss. And, probably coming up into the last few days of Nan's life, Mum came to me and said, "Oh, look, you know, you got to go in and talk to her and, you know, tell her what you want to say and, tell her you love her and all that sort of stuff because she's, you know, basically she's not going to be here forever." And being 18 and, young and dumb, I suppose, I sort of went, I'll do it tomorrow, And then the day came that she actually passed and Mum said, "Look, your sister's going in there to talk to her. Go and talk to her." And I'd organised a barbecue up at my partner's house at the time. And I said, "Oh, no, look, I'll do it later, Mum. I'll be back in a few hours." And, headed up the mountain and had a few beers and got a call, I reckon, about it would have been late. It would have been about 9 or 10 o'clock. Get here now. Nan's not going to last much longer. And I remember like driving down the mountain and I suppose I don't know if I was in a bit of shock or what it was, or I was pissed, or maybe I just didn't believe it. But I remember driving down the mountain and I would have thought, like I look back at it now and I would have thought if I heard that now I'd be hysterical. I mean, my sister called me the other day and said, "Dad, he ended up having fluid on the lungs and couldn't breathe and stuff, and I'd bawl my eyes out and I freaking rushed to the hospital." And, you know, and to get told that someone who was really special to me, she was really, really special to me, as most Nans are, to get told that she's going to die, and, you know, I sort of just drove down the mountain and ran inside and there was no tears or anything. And I suppose, I got there and ran in the door and everyone was in the room and Nan was sort of there for maybe a minute or two, and I remember Mum saying, "It's okay, Ma. It's okay, Ma. You know, you can go now. Everyone's here." And she looked around the room and, took her last breath, the death rattle, I suppose they call it, and that was it, mate. And I ran outside and fucking flipped the table and kicked the chairs and, you know, just fell on the ground and was crying and all that sort of stuff. And at the time, obviously, because I just lost Nan, I was, you know, upset and devastated and, sad and all that sort of stuff. but I didn't really, I didn't realise the effect that would later have on me. Still to this day, I think about my sister and my aunties and mum and, you know, what did Nan say? Did Nan say anything to them? What did they say to them? Like, and that's something that I'm never going to get back. I'm never going to get that chance to tell her I love her give me a sec, mate.
You're all right. Yeah, I'll take your time.
Yeah, I suppose. Oh, fuck.
Take your time. It's hard talking about this stuff and
Terry. Yeah, so it obviously still hits fucking a soft spot with me, and it kills me, mate. It does. Like, I think about it all the time. And, you know, mum and the family go up to the cemetery for her birthday and all that sort of shit. And every time mum calls me, she knows I'm not going to go, but she calls me, son, do you want to come? Do you want to come? Nah, I just can't do it, mate. I can't even – I fucking hate it. I hate going there. I hate the whole situation. You know, and I suppose I probably carried – I mean, it was out of my control, but I probably carried a lot of blame, not because, you know, she died, but because – you know, mum would always tell me, like, you know, you got to go and see Nan. She asked about you. Every time I talked to her, she asked about you. And I sort of just, you know, I suppose I just blew it off and just didn't want to deal with it. I didn't want to go and see Nan, you know, someone who was, you know, everyone's rock and all that sort of stuff. And I didn't want to go and see her hurting and you know, in a bad way. And I just... Yeah, but now it fucking cuts me, mate, and there's nothing I can do about it. Like, you know, I'll never get that time back. It's something I've got to live with, and I'm starting to deal with. But yeah, it's shit ass. It's real shit.
I think a bit of solitude with this is that a lot of 18-year-olds would have probably done the same thing as you. You mentioned the word rock, and that's what my nan is to me as well, and. You know, she's gone through a lot of health stuff. And as you mentioned, you know, she got told 6 months to live and she lasted 12. As an 18-year-old, you think she's going to keep going. She's going to keep going.
Yeah, you do.
So it is a natural thing. And as we sort of spoke about, we don't you sort of adapt to this situation. You did, and you continue to drink and take drugs and stuff like that. You spoke about what turned it around briefly with, you know, losing your partner and going into the men's behavioural program. You know, that at that point in time, why did you actually make that decision to do that?
Probably because I'd lost so much, I suppose. That's why. I mean, you know, probably I'd lost so much. I'd fucked up two families. You know, I'd hurt two people that mean a lot to me, in Kylie and Bridie. And probably most of all, I hurt me two boys. The way things finished with both of them due to my actions and whatnot weren't nice. Sort of had to pay the price, which I probably blame them for, of not seeing them while I was in that state. You know, I mean my boys, which I sort of blame the you know, Kylie and Brody for, which now I look at it and it was probably fair enough. I wouldn't want my kids around me, or anyone for that matter, you know, drinking heavily and doing drugs. It's not something that I wanted to be around as a kid, but unfortunately was, you know, exposed to. And I always said that I wouldn't do it to my kids. And, you know, I was sort of somewhat a hypocrite, you know, by wanting to be there and be a so-called father, yet continue to drink and do drugs and, you know, be there when it suited me.
So, like, I know, I mean, I've seen posts, I've heard things, and I know how tough it has been for you at times, and you do bring a good point that you did blame them at the time, but you look back now and you understand it, and that's a huge turnaround in such a short amount of time. Like, a turnaround like that in mindset doesn't change in an instant. It changes by doing the work. What is the work you've done on yourself to make sure that you can be a better parent, or a parent that's going to be more helpful for their kids?
Okay. So probably the first thing I done was that men's behaviour change program. Now, I'm just going to talk about something quickly that really opened my eyes during the course. So we done this, I suppose you'd call it a little project up on the board, and we had two sides, and one was the man you were taught to be, And we had to write things. Okay, so the first one was things like, you know, don't cry, be tough, you know, men are expendable, all these hard sort of traits that I suppose us as men were taught, you know, to have and you know, and to aspire to be. And then on the other side, on the flip side, was the man you want to be, okay? And it had things, you know, like compassionate and loving and lovable and, you know, very soft sort of things. And it was a real eye-opener to me, probably affected me more than anything in the thing, because I sort of grew up as the first side, but the whole time wanted to be that compassionate, loving, loyal, you know, lovable type of man, and I wasn't. So that was probably, even though I was doing the course, that was probably the big turning point for me to actually see what I was and everything that I had to do to get on the other side, you know, of the board, because I probably didn't hold. I probably didn't have any of those sort of soft, you know, traits. So that was probably, the biggest turning point for me during that course. So I've done that course. Yeah, go, mate.
Did that also show you that it was possible? Because you probably didn't think it was possible before that. You actually now are seeing it right in front of your face. I can actually move from one side to the other. It's actually possible for me.
It certainly opened my eyes a lot. You know, obviously, you sort of think about it, but after being a certain way for 25-odd years, you know, you sort of just – it's your normal. It's, you know, like my childhood growing up, just normal to me, and this basically my attitude towards it, I suppose, was this is me. You know, if no one likes it, you can get fucked pretty much. That's sort of why I ended up you know, sort of in the holes that I was in. So, yeah, I done that men's course, which went for about 20 weeks, and yeah, passed that, and then met a new girl, Abby, and sort of kicked things off with her, and things were going really good, mate. I got a big book of all the work I'd done, and I was making sure I was going over it, and all that sort of stuff, doing a few check-ins and all that sort of stuff, and really working hard on myself, and I suppose got a bit complacent with how I was feeling, and you know, thought this is easy. I don't need to do this stuff anymore. You know, I'm a changed man and all that sort of stuff after, after 27, 28 years of learned behaviors, thing in 20 weeks was my, you know, 20 weeks and an hour every week was the turning point for me. And, it certainly wasn't. So things sort of, I suppose, didn't, not to the extent that I had gone to before, but the drinking and all that sort of stuff sort of started up again, and yet again led to another failed relationship, which I'm trying so desperately to sort of work out. So since then I've gotten into seeing a psychologist. I've been seeing a psychologist for about 3 months now. Every week I see her about once or twice a week, and I'm also seeing a relationship counsellor, not specifically for Abby and myself, but more just for me, and to, I suppose, learn, which she said was really rare. She doesn't have anyone else that comes to see him by herself. I just working on things, about myself, things I can improve in a relationship, you know, I suppose we just talk about all sorts of different stuff, and that's pretty much what I'm doing at the moment. So I see the relationship counselor every second week. They're both at the same place, so I just do a double booking every second week and see them both. Just working on myself, keeping fit, keeping busy, staying away from the people that I tend to get in a bit of trouble with, and staying away from the alcohol and the drugs. So it is hard, mate. It's like, you know, I certainly not so much at the moment because everyone's in the same boat staying home. But once all this happened, you know, seeing people sort of go out and, you know, and partying and stuff, and knowing that I wasn't in their headspace to actually do that, and, you know, to be able to be around those sort of people, I suppose sort of cut me a little bit. But that's the price I got to pay for making wrong decisions, I suppose. So, yeah, that's sort of where I'm at now. And, yeah, that's it, mate. Yeah.
I think you bring up other really important points as well. Like, I speak to a lot of males who want to go to counsellors because they want to. Now, I'm not saying you don't want to do this as well, because I know you do, but they go to relationship counsellors, they go to counsellors because they want to win a girl back, or they want to save that what they're in now. But you brought up a really good point, and I think people need to listen to it, is that you're going to a relationship counsellor to help you in whatever relationships you might have going forward. Now, I don't know the exact current situation, but if it works out with Abby, then so be it. But I think it's really vital that you're going there not for an individual, but for yourself to actually help in the future, because too many, and I was one of these people, I would be like, no, I'll go see this person for you. But when you do it for someone, you're actually not doing it for yourself. So you'll end up falling back into the same trap again.
Yeah, yeah. So yeah. A lot of people have, you know, when I when we split up, a lot of people said to me, you know, you got to do it for you. You can't do it for anyone else. All this sort of stuff, and it sort of bugged me a little bit. Like it sort of pissed me off. And you know, even Abby's mum said, you know, you got to do what you got to do. You know, you don't live your life for someone else and all that sort of stuff. And sort of, you know, you can't go and see this person, or you can't do this, you know, you got to do it for you. And I went and spoke to my counsellor, and I said, fucking, you know, everyone keeps telling me, buddy, you know, I got to do this for myself and all that sort of stuff. And she said, you know what, that's fucking bullshit. She said, it's not, what did she say? She said, it's not the, she said, you can do it for anyone, but it's the reasoning behind it, is what she said. She said, if you want to go out and you want to do it for you and your family, you do that. But as long as you're not doing it just to get that person back or just to make someone happy, if you're going out there because you want to be better and, you know, you're going to work on yourself and all that sort of stuff, you can have any sort of reason behind it as long as you're willing to put in the work. You know, and that sort of opened my eyes, and, you know, sort of gave me a different look at it, and yeah, sort of made me realize that I don't have to just do it for myself. I want to do it for my family and all that sort of stuff. Obviously I want to be better and be a better person and all that sort of stuff, but I want to be a better person for the people that mean a lot to me. And yeah, the way she sort of explained it to me, you know, being, yeah, there's got to be a positive reason behind it, not just because, you know, someone's pissed off at you or you want to get someone back or just to make someone happy.
Yeah.
If you're doing it for positive reasons and, you know, it's not just a bullshit, I'm going to do this, you know, and get what you want and then that's it, you can have any reason. So I thought that was really good, the way she sort of explained it to me. And yeah, I suppose it gave me a lot of positivity and, yeah, that I was doing the right thing. And, yeah.
I think it's a pretty perfect summarisation of what, yeah, because you are right. There's different things that drive different people, but it is when you're focused on an individual, like focused on something that doesn't involve you, that yet when you're not working on yourself, that it does. It's you're like basically acting for a period of time. And it's manipulation, and then you get what you want and then you slip back into it because you haven't worked on yourself. Whereas the way it's summarised with you, it's you are doing it for everyone around you, but you're involved in that. It's a ripple effect of what's going to happen. So I think that way you've described that really, really, really good. Now, before we're going to talk about your ride that's hopefully coming up soon, but otherwise it'll be postponed to a later date. Is there anything else you, I guess you'd like to touch on for that part of your story before we touch on the next part of your story?
Probably just to anyone listening that's going through a similar sort of thing or anything like that. It is doable. I mean, I've been in the darkest places, you know, that no one sort of wants to be. You know, I've spoken to you about a lot of those things and, yes, yeah. Probably some spots that I thought, you know, this is it. I'm done, mate. And, yeah, probably just the people out there that are going through a struggle is just, you know, speak out and talk and put in the work is probably the biggest thing. I sort of have always sat back and, you know, blamed everyone else and, you know, thought, oh, fuck, it's not my fault or, you know, I'm okay and all that sort of stuff. But, yeah, probably speak about it and secondly, put in the work and, yeah, just don't give up. Because, yeah, like I said, it certainly is doable. I've been, yeah, to a lot of places that people sort of don't want to be, and I've seen it certainly happen in front of my eyes. Lost two of my really good mates because, you know, they sort of grew up and didn't really talk about anything. Yeah, so just talk. The message is out there. Talk to anyone, you know, whether it be a stranger running down the street or, yeah, just anyone. Just let it out, and whether you got to scream or fucking cry or whatever you got to do, just get it out and get it out in the open and let someone know so you're not suffering in silence, because it's I've been there and I've done it to myself. It's fucking hell.
It is your own living hell,
yeah.
Basically, so that's great advice. Now, you did mention briefly that you've lost two mates in the last couple of years to suicide, blokes who never spoke up, and you're doing a ride which is hopefully June 1st, but maybe pushed back a little bit. I mean, basically, I'll leave it up to you to talk about this because I don't know these too well. I've heard a lot about them in the last couple of years, but yeah, I'll leave it up to you and the stories that you want to share behind them and reflect, I guess, on them as people.
All right, let's do it. Firstly, I'll talk about Michael, or Shez, as everyone knows him. He's probably one of my best mates growing up. Unfortunately, we sort of fell out just due to work and stuff as we got a bit older. But I went through everything with him. I went through, you know, crèche, kinder, primary school and high school. Now, we played footy together all through our juniors. All our mums were really good mates. And, he was a really good dude. He sort of reached out to me just about work and all that sort of stuff. Coming up into, I suppose, what you'd say the last few months of his life. I spoke to him a little bit. It was good to catch up, and I got a call from one of my other good mates who was probably Mick's, probably Shez's best mate, very close family friend, Daniel. And which was really weird. We speak a bit, but he doesn't usually call me that often. He called me and said, "Oh, you know, can we talk and all that sort of stuff?" And I sort of went, "Yeah, what's going on? This is a bit weird." And yeah, then he told me the news that Michael was gone and then taken his own life. And and I just remember going, "Fucking what?" What? And he's like, oh, and he just kept repeating it. And I just was like, I just couldn't believe it. I'm like, nah, get fucked. Nah, it's not fucking true. You know, what are you trying to tell me? And then hung up the phone, and I remember I called Mum straight away and told her, and she was like, what the fuck? What the hell is going on? You know, what's going on in the world? And, you know, what the fuck's wrong with all these kids and all that sort of stuff? And, you know, growing up, you know, best mates and me, him and Daniel sort of, it was just us three, you know, sort of a little tripod, you know, through our primary school and high school and footy and whatnot. Hung out every weekend and all sorts of stuff. So, yeah, growing up, he was happy. He was a good dude. You know, come from a really loving family. You know, he was a good footballer, very good academically. You know, and all sorts of stuff. And I went to his funeral, and we were sitting there, and they were talking about him. And the person said, "Oh, not many of you people might know." And being his best, like one of his best mates growing up, you know, throughout his whole life, he actually struggled with depression from when he was about 10, 11. And we had no idea, mate.
Wow.
You know, he was basically like a brother to Daniel, and I don't even think he might have known, but I don't think to the extent of what he was actually going through. So, yeah, it goes to show that I suppose it can strike you know, anyone, even, you know, the people that you like. I suppose I sort of looked up to him, and you know, he was like a brother to me. He was a best mate. He was always there, you know, and always looked out for me and my best interests and everyone around him. And I suppose probably looked out for other people more than himself, probably to, I suppose, make him feel a bit better and compensate for the struggles that he was, I suppose, going through, which is sad. You know, it sort of made me really sad that, first of all, I didn't probably pay enough attention to realize what he was going through, you know, and not being able to be there for him. Then secondly, probably a real eye-opener that it can affect anyone, obviously, in, you know, sort of different forms and different, I suppose, how would you word it? I suppose it affects people a lot more than other people, you know, whereas some people might have a few issues, whereas other people don't really have the coping mechanisms to, you know, to get through that sort of stuff. And I suppose that really opened my eyes to what was happening, you know, in and around me. And I suppose helped me notice that, you know, people won't talk about bad things. I suppose we've been so used to being brought up, you know, everyone applauds you for, you know, for kicking 5 goals on the weekend or you know, for whatever it may be, anything good. But you know, it's sort of not so much anymore, but it used to be, I suppose, you would have felt sort of looked down on to be struggling and to have these struggles and all that sort of stuff. So, it sort of really opened my eyes. Like, I mean, you know, to be best mates with someone and not know that the struggles that they were going through. It can affect anyone, and you know, not everyone talks about it. And I suppose the biggest lesson is just check up on people, regardless of whether you think they're doing, you know, they're doing really well, or you know, they're struggling. I suppose always check in with your mates and family and, you know, strangers or whatever. I mean, I see people all the time, you know, posting things on Facebook that I've never even met that seem like they're struggling, and you know, I just make the effort to send them a message to, you know, say you're doing well, and you know, keep going. If I'm here, I'm here. Because looking back, I suppose, that would have really helped me, and I hope if I can make a difference, even if it's one person, I really hope that it makes their day better, or you know, at least puts a smile on their face. So yeah, that's a bit about Mick. It's devastating.
I think
yep, go, mate.
Yeah, you speak about his struggles that you didn't know about from an early age, and I mean, you had your struggles from an early age as well. Like for kids, that, you know, well, but even adults, I think if we actually spoke to our friends, our good friends, you'd probably find out that maybe they're going through the same battles as you are now. We're in a time now where we're at 30, we're getting married, there's kids, there's houses, so we're going through the same shit as the people around us. So you can actually speak to them and find out how they're going and how they're doing things better, because they might be able to give you some advice that might help you, and you might be able to help them with something. So I think it's a really clear message that speak to the people around you as often as you can, and don't be afraid to just open up and say, I'm struggling a little bit. Can you help? Can you just listen? Whatever it might be, because maybe in a different era, you and Michael as kids might have, maybe not, but I think the message is just to talk to each other.
Yeah, certainly. Even, I mean, I think there's probably a lot of people talk to people not so much for the wrong reasons, but once they realise something's wrong, I mean, you know, it probably takes something bad. For like a lot of things, it usually takes something bad to happen for people to actually, you know, speak about it or to reach out to a mate. I don't see why we don't, you know, pick up the phone and say, hey, mate, how you doing? And, like, you know, sort of we call up and go, oh, fucking let's go to the pub, or, you know, or do you want to go and kick the footy or something like that? But we won't pick up the phone and just say, hey, mate, how are you? So I don't think you got to, you know, I suppose be intrusive or, you know, go looking for something, but just even just a phone call, just to talk, I suppose, would help people in similar situations, or even people that aren't in those situations, you know, would just let them know that if they do tend to come across a struggle, that you are there, and, you know, hopefully they do reach out.
Yeah, fantastic. Now, Jake, who I've heard a lot about, great guy.
Yeah, he certainly was, mate. It was very public. What happened with JP? They had a thing on a current affair for him with his mum and his sister and a few other people that were really close to him. Now, same sort of thing. I got a phone call and you know, sort of. I'll talk about him a bit about him first. Growing up, he was the opposition that you love to hate. I mean, he played footy at Box Hill, you know, won a state championship, and you know, all the girls loved him, and he was a superstar footballer, and, you know, a really great bloke. But sort of one of those guys that could do it all and had it all, but you know, behind closed doors was really struggling, you know, and probably. From what I can see, probably use that as a bit of an escape, you know, used all of his sort of, I suppose, success to push down what he was actually going through and all that sort of stuff. So me and Jakey probably fell away, and like me and Mike, just due to work and you know, family commitments and all sorts of stuff as we got a bit older, but. Yeah, sort of grew up with him, you know, playing footy against him and all that sort of stuff. He was a really happy, really loud, sort of life of the party sort of dude. You know, when he was around, you were laughing and smiling and you know, probably acting a bit like a dickhead like he always used to. He was a good dude and could always put a smile on your face and. Had it all, mate. From, you know, if you were someone just outside looking in, you know, even someone that was sort of, I suppose, on the inner sanctum with him, you didn't really know what he was going through. He always sort of had issues, and they were always out there. He was pretty vocal, whether it be by social media or, you know, face to face. He was always sort of voicing, you know, how he was feeling and all that sort of stuff, and. One of my good mates, Tom, he was really close with Jakey, and I actually hadn't seen him. I used to play basketball with him, and hadn't seen him until, you know, Jake's funeral, and even he didn't really, you know the extent to what Jakey what Jakey was going through. Yeah, I suppose so. He ended up taking his life at his house. Which was, I suppose hard, and a bit gut wrenching. Someone called me and said, oh, you know, 50, Fitzy's passed, and this is what's happened, and all that sort of stuff. So that was pretty hard, and probably what hit me the hardest is I went to his funeral and saw everyone that I grew up with, and all that sort of stuff, and it's amazing at a funeral, you know, the people that you may not have seen for years or may not have even heard of, the amount of people that show up to a funeral, you know, it shows the amount of care that this person actually had and the support that they had around them. And, you know, maybe if they had reached out, that we wouldn't have ended up there. It's just, I suppose that's probably the one amazing thing that you can take out of a funeral is it is actually surprising every time I go to one. God help, I don't go to many more, but it is surprising how many people, whether you knew them personally or from afar, that actually care. You know, even strangers or whoever it may be. And one thing that probably hit me the hardest there was after he got taken away and all that sort of stuff, I went up to his dad, Dave, and gave him a big hug, and, you know, I said, you know, I'm sorry, mate, and a bit of tears and that, and he said, this is fucking bullshit. You know, a father shouldn't have to bury his son. Hang on, mate.
Yeah. You're all right.
Yeah, that fucking, that really hit home. It's tough, man. That was tough to hear, and he's right. Like, we're losing so many people. Like, my cousin, he's only 20, and he's lost about six or seven, you know, mates to suicide. And my uncle through footy, you know, coached all the juniors and stuff, and, you know, couldn't get out of bed after one of the kids he, you know, approached, committed suicide, and, you know, held a lot of guilt for it and all that sort of stuff. So it affects a lot of people, not just while the person's going through it or you're going through it, even after there's certainly a long-term ripple effect, especially if it comes down to suicide, you know, being the outcome, certainly affects people for a long, long time. So that's what happened with Jake, and it's shit, mate. You don't want to lose anyone, but you don't want to lose, you know, the greats, because it's fucking shit.
Yeah, and I think you bring up some very valid points. Is, you know, when you see that many people at a funeral, there's that many people that, you know. And we probably are a little bit flippant with our, we're here if we need it, if you need it, and then we get too busy. And I think through COVID-19, we're actually starting to realise how flippant we probably are with that, with the care of people. But the realistic thing is that everyone in that room would rather have been there, but been a fucking nightmare of a person to live with because he's going through a lot of shit, than to actually have been in that room. And I think that's the reoccurring story is, if you're going through it, people would rather go through it with you than to see you be buried. But also to the people that don't understand it and that are the friend, you know, remember, you would rather them be a shit friend sometimes or a person that's grieving or struggling than to have to watch them be buried. We try and tiptoe around this, but that's the fact. And unfortunately, if we don't deal with it in facts and with rawness and bluntness, then it's going to keep happening. So people need to understand that we have to be blunt about this, because we need to save the people around us, because it's fucking, like, I don't know them personally, but I'm like getting emotional about this because we're losing too many people that we can save ultimately. So. What you are doing a ride in honor of those two. What is the stupidity that you're doing?
Probably Mick and Jake are probably the driving force behind it, but also anyone else that's going through the same sort of struggles. This isn't just about two people. It's about us as a whole. So I just thought I'd mention that. So yeah, the plan is to ride to Adelaide from I'm actually the plan is so there's a ride from Adelaide. So I'm going to go to Jake's house. I'm going to leave there at about 8 o'clock in the morning, hopefully on June the 1st, depending on how we go with the virus stuff. If I can't, then it'll just get pushed back till a date that I can actually do it. It's going ahead regardless. So I'll leave. I'll go to Jake's house, sort of pay a bit of respects and, take a few photos and that sort of stuff. And then I'll head off on my ride. I'll be stopping in Wantirna South at the funeral home where we had Michael's funeral. Taking a few photos there and paying my respects to Mick, and then I'll be heading off on my ride to Adelaide. So the plan is to do 8 stops. I'm hoping to be able to push through a few stops and make it 7 and get there in a week. So the first stop will be in Ballon, which is about 97 k's from Boronia. I'll stop there. I'm going to get a few T-shirts made up, getting a few sponsors and all that sort of stuff. So, yeah, the plan is to stop in Ballon and then a place called Buangor, and then Horsham, and then Caneva, and then Tintinara, and then Alwampul, and then Callington, and then to finish at the Eastern Region's Men's Shed in Marriottville. I've been in talks with them. they're real supportive about it. They're going to have a bit of a men's day on there and all that sort of stuff over in South Australia. So that's basically the plan. I'll be riding by myself, which will be a lot of fun. Either I'll be sleeping in the swag, or I'll find some sort of accommodation along the way.
I'm sure the little country towns will be able to help you out with a room for a night.
Yeah, certainly. So I sort of a lot of people have been telling me you can't do it by yourself and, you should get a crew behind you and all that sort of stuff. But I come to the realisation that I'm doing this for men's mental health, and when you are going through mental health struggles, you feel alone. So I am going to do it alone and do it by myself and I suppose sort of push through things that, I suppose other people could help me sort of get through when it's getting tough or it's a hard ride or, all that sort of stuff. So I think it's important that I do it by myself, just to honour obviously Mick and Fitzy, and everyone else that's going through a similar sort of thing. So that's basically a rundown about what's going to happen. I'm going to stop in every town and hopefully talk to a few people and hopefully get a few things going in different towns and leave a bit of a souvenir, a T-shirt or whatever it may be, just to raise a bit of awareness, hopefully get it put up in a pub or something like that. And, that's basically the plan. I've got a page on Facebook. It's called Pete's Ride to Radelaide.
I'll share that in the show notes as well.
Yep. So you can jump on and follow all the progress there and photos and teaming up with a few people. Danielle's artwork, Danielle Weber is her name. Teaming up with her, she's gonna send me a few pictures and stuff to auction off and all that sort of stuff, which is gonna go to Beyond Blue. I partnered up with them as well for the ride. With a GoFundMe page, so all the proceeds from all those sort of raffles and other things. There's a few other things in the works with a few gyms and supplement stores and all that sort of stuff. I'm going to get a few hopefully get a few memberships to a few different gyms and little packs and party bags and all that sort of stuff. So that's all in the works. So if you jump onto Pete's Ride to Adelaide on Facebook, you'll be able to look up all that stuff and follow it and all that. There's also like I said, the the GoFundMe page, which is the same Pete's Ride to Adelaide. You can jump on there. Every dollar counts, and it's going to to a cause, to a people, and to a fund that I suppose hopefully get out the stigma of not talking and all that sort of stuff. So something I'm really passionate about, and I mean, I wouldn't be putting myself through a 800K ride if I didn't really care about what I'm doing and all that sort of stuff. So yeah, that's basically the rundown of the ride, and I don't know want to know anything else, or yeah, so that's it.
I think it's awesome what you're doing. I think it's fantastic putting yourself through, and I think you hit the nail on the head when you're going through a lot of these battles, you feel like you are immensely alone, and you don't feel like there's anyone out there. And I guess you're probably going to go through that for the 7 days, and I'm sure there'll be people along the way that'll be willing to help you out and put you up. I'm sure there would be. I'll put you up for a night and get your electricity so you can charge your phone and speak to anyone you need to speak to. And you spoke about sponsors for the t-shirts. Do they just get in contact directly with you with that?
Yeah, mate. So you can either just email me. I'm gonna do. I've done a major sponsor. Which Evoke Supplements in Dandenong are going to do. Otherwise, mate, I just whatever I can fit on the t-shirt. I'm going to try and make a minimum, probably a $50 minimum for a sponsorship to go on the t-shirt. They will get dropped off at every stop, and hopefully, I can get a few made up. I'm still in talks with a company that's going to do all this sort of stuff for me. Hopefully, I can get a t-shirt for everyone that is willing to sponsor and all that sort of stuff. So yeah, it will be a $50 minimum. Anything, whether it be a business or just a person, whatever you want me to put on the t-shirt is what will go on. So a $50 sponsorship, or obviously anything more would be great. But that is the plan, to get a few t-shirts made up, and I'm going to get a few more made up just for everyone. I mean, it would be nice to give something back. Yep. So yeah, that's the go with the sponsorships. If just get in contact, probably via Facebook, or I'm sure most people have my number. It's everywhere. So in any sort of format, just contact me, mate. And I'm sure we can sort something out.
Well, power, strength, and vulnerability will throw in $250. I'll put that on the record now and get the ball rolling, and hopefully people listening will sort of match that or even go higher if they want.
Beautiful.
I think as much as the money goes to a great cause, it also gives you that extra motivation on those minutes and seconds where you want to back out, and then you go, shit, I've had these 10 people reach, put their hands in their pockets. I've got to keep going. I think it does add that extra incentive. So I'll get the ball rolling for there, and hopefully people will match it and get that promotion as well that they can get from it.
Yeah, beautiful, mate. That's awesome. Thanks heaps for that.
No worries. We'll sort that out off air. We won't sort out details on here, but I guess that's it for my questions for today. I want to say thank you. I really appreciate you putting yourself out there like that, about your story, but also I think paying respect to a couple of those guys is really admirable. There's no doubt that their families and friends think about them all the time, and I think it's really, I think personally, speaking about people that have passed is a really lovely thing to do. It does upset people, but at the same time, they're upset anyway. So you may as well talk about them and remember them for the great people they were. So thank you. If there is anything you'd like to add, feel free.
Not really, mate. I think we've gone through most of it, but I think the thing we're trying to, accomplish from from this is just to raise awareness and just to tell people that it is okay. It ain't weak to speak, I suppose, is the going sort of lingo at the moment. You know, and just reach out just to anyone, just talk about it, because it does make you feel better. It does make you feel better, and it makes those hard days, I suppose, a little bit easier. And, you know, I suppose helps you see that there is a new day on the other side. And, yeah, the grass is greener. You just got to be willing to put in the work and, you know, and keep doing it. And I suppose, I don't really know where to go from there, mate. Just keep your head up, and you know, everyone's there for you. Just bloody, you know, reach out and say something. I mean, I'm not the greatest talker, as you could probably tell from the whole podcast.
but no, you've done well.
I am happy to listen. You know, my phone's always on, my door's always open. You know, so just reach out, whether it be to me, Shane, you know, or anyone, because everyone is willing to help and everyone wants to listen. But we can't help if you're gonna do it on your own. So just yell out, and you know, hopefully we can knock out this fucking bullshit silent killer, and everyone starts talking a little bit more, and you know, we can all live together and all be happy. And that's I suppose the end aim.
Awesome, mate. I'll leave it at that. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Shane.
Thanks for listening to Power, Strength and Vulnerability, the mental health podcast. If anything in this podcast has brought up difficult feelings, please call Lifeline on 13 1144. For any further information, or if you want to bring your story to life, contact Shane at shane@vitalityfit.com.au. That's VITALITYFITT.com.au.